Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really monumental figure, Benjamin Franklin. Not just important historically, but someone who arguably, well, defined a whole way of thinking about success and self-improvement that we still live with.
Absolutely. And we're mainly looking at him through Walter Isaacson's fantastic 2003 biography, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life. Incredibly thorough.
Right.
And Franklin, you know, 1706 to 1790, people often put him in boxes.
Yeah.
Inventor, diplomat, printer, founding father.
Sure, the usual list.
But Isaacson's big idea, his thesis really, is that Franklin was this ultimate polymath who didn't just live the American story. He basically invented the template for the American character.
Yeah.
You know, the whole idea of the self-made person.
Okay, that's a huge claim. Inventing an archetype. What makes his story so significant for someone listening right now? Why should you care today?
Because his story is just pure possibility, isn't it? I mean, think about it. He starts out as the son of a pretty humble soap and candle maker in Boston, 15th of 17 kids.
Wow. Yeah, the odds were definitely not in his favor for achieving global fame.
Exactly. No inherited status, no wealth, not much formal education. But Franklin proved, or at least his story suggests, that anyone, really anyone, could use their own wit, hard work, and crucially, self-education to completely reinvent themselves and rise right to the top.
So his life is kind of the ultimate proof of concept, that merit can beat your background.
That's the idea Isaacson pushes, that in America, merit could overcome class.
Okay, so let's trace that journey. Back to Boston, 1706. 15 out of 17 kids. That sounds chaotic.
It must have been bustling, yeah. And modest means, for sure. But intellectually, surprisingly rich in a way. His father, Josiah, saw Benjamin was sharp early on.
But couldn't afford college, right?
Couldn't afford Harvard, no. So Josiah basically made the dinner table of the university. He encouraged formal debates, argumentation, taught young Ben how to make a point, defend it, but also how not to tick everyone off while doing it.
Crucial skill. But the actual school stopped at age 10.
Yes, money ran out. And that moment, well, it shaped his entire approach to learning. At 12, he gets apprenticed legally bound to his older brother, James, a printer.
And the print shop becomes his real education.
His university, exactly. He wasn't just setting type. He was reading everything he could get his hands on. Late nights poring over books.
But that relationship with James, it wasn't easy, was it? I remember reading it was quite abusive.
He was contentious, yeah. James could be harsh, demanding. And that hardship was really formative for Franklin's later style, especially in politics.
How so?
Well, he learned very quickly that just confronting his powerful older brother head on, that was pointless. It just got him into trouble.
Led to beatings, apparently.
Right. So he had to figure out how to get his ideas across more subtly, how to influence things without direct confrontation.
Which leads us straight to Silence Do Good.
Ah, yes. The teenage genius move. He creates this fake persona, a witty middle-aged widow named Silence Do Good, and slips her opinion essays under the print shop door. Anonymously, of course.
And they were a hit.
Hugely popular.
Mm.
But when he finally fessed up that he was the author, well, James was furious. But the lesson was learned. Clever persuasion, using a persona, maybe a bit of strategic anonymity.
Yeah.
These were way more effective tools, politically and socially, than just arguing or complaining loudly. Influence beats anger, you know.
That makes sense. And that lesson seems to inform his next big risky move. Yeah. Age 17, 1723.
Yeah.
He breaks his indenture, which was illegal, and just runs away to Philadelphia.
Yes, a defining moment. And it's the origin story he really crafted for himself. Isaacson paints that picture so well. Franklin arriving in Philly, looking pretty rough, totally alone.
With the three puffy bread rolls under his arm, that image sticks.
It really does. It symbolizes everything. Vulnerability, hunger, but also that absolute break from his past. He was consciously creating a new identity, one based purely on what he could do.
And once he's in Philadelphia, he doesn't just work hard randomly. He starts organizing, systematizing his own growth. He builds a network.
Right. He knew he needed a system. Continuous learning, civic engagement that led to the Gento.
Which wasn't just a book club.
Oh, no. Much more than that. It was a club for mutual improvement, a structured forum where ambitious young tradesmen like him could discuss business, politics, philosophy, science. It became this absolute engine for civic change in the city.
The impact was huge, wasn't it? The first subscription library came out of that fire company, the seed for the University of Pennsylvania.
All flowed directly from the Gento discussions. That's the Franklin model right there. Personal ambition channeled into collective benefit. And he was a media master, too, buying the Pennsylvania Gazette, publishing Poor Richard's Almanac.
Which was a massive bestseller, a penny saved is a penny earned, and all that.
Exactly. He was basically writing down a practical, useful American morality. Stuff that worked for everyday people. It really shaped early American values.
And then comes a point we sort of skipped over, but is, I think, kind of revolutionary for his career path. He retires from active business at only 42.
Yeah, mid-1740s, financially independent already.
Yeah.
It's pretty astonishing for a tradesman back then.
What did that mean, retire? He didn't exactly stop working.
Not at all. He just pivoted completely. Mm. He decided to dedicate the rest of his life, almost 50 more years, entirely to science and public service.
Wow.
He shifted his focus from just making money to gaining knowledge and, well, contributing to the greater good. This is a lot about his priorities.
So let's talk about that contribution. His scientific work is what really put him on the map internationally first, right?
Absolutely. The electricity experiments weren't just a hobby. They were serious, systematic, and they led, of course, to the famous kite experiment.
Which made him a global celebrity.
It did. Earned him huge acclaim, membership in the prestigious Royal Society in London. It transformed him from the successful colonial printer into a recognized European intellectual figure. And the lightning rod, the practical result.
Instantly useful. Very Franklin.
Very Franklin. Practical, visible benefit.
And that scientific credibility, that fame, becomes the key to his later diplomatic success, securing the French alliance during the Revolution.
It was absolutely crucial. When he went to France as America's first ambassador, he wasn't just some colonial politician. He was Benjamin Franklin, the scientist who tamed lightning.
And he played that role perfectly.
Oh, he was a master performer. He understood the French court's romantic ideas about America. So instead of trying to be like them, he played up the rustic, wise American philosopher image. The plain hair, no wig, the famous fur cap.
The fur cap, right.
He used that image, plus his scientific reputation and his natural charm, to win over the French and get the money and military support that America desperately needed. He didn't just represent America. In their eyes, he kind of was America.
Amazing. And then his final big public act, the Constitutional Convention. He was 81 by then.
81. Frail. Often in pain. But still indispensable. Isaacson really emphasizes his role there. It wasn't about fiery speeches. It was about being the wise elder, the one who could bridge the gaps.
Forging compromise.
Exactly. Using his immense moral authority, his diplomatic skill, even his humor, to get the different factions to agree. Effectiveness and consensus, those were always his goals.
So if we try to boil all this down, the junto, the science, the almanac, the diplomacy, what's the absolute core of Franklin's philosophy?
It's got to be pragmatism, pure and simple. He wasn't really interested in abstract theories or deep theology. For Franklin, an idea was only good if it worked, if it produced real, tangible, beneficial results in the world.
If it didn't work,
he'd discard it or tweak it. His whole life was like one big empirical test.
Which sounds like a good way to understand his famous project of moral perfection, that list of 13 virtues he tried to master. Was that about being a saint?
Not really, no. It was much more practical than that. Temperance, silence, order, industry, frugality, and so on.
Yeah.
He saw these as practical tools. Tools to make him more effective, more successful, maybe happier.
Tools, not commandments.
Exactly. He even kept a little book, like a ledger, and scored himself daily on how well he lived up to each virtue.
So the process, the trying, was the main point, not actually achieving perfection.
Precisely. He openly admitted he never achieved perfection. He famously said trying to achieve order just made him realize how disorderly he naturally was. But the striving, the daily habit of self-reflection and trying to improve just a little bit, that was the key. It was basically the scientific method applied to his own character.
So what was driving him? This constant push for improvement, for advancement? Was it just ambition?
Isaacson points to, I think, three main drivers working together. One, yes. Definitely the drive for material success and social advancement. He wanted to rise above those humble beginnings. Two, a genuine, relentless pursuit of knowledge. Pure curiosity drove his scientific work. And three, a pretty strong desire for lasting fame. But fame earned through contributing to human welfare. That's why he put so much energy into civic projects.
What about his approach to setbacks, to opposition? He seemed unusually calm about it sometimes.
Yeah, he didn't seem to take it personally. Most of the time. He treated obstacles almost like technical problems, things to be solved using reason, patience, and working with others.
Not just fighting them.
Right. And he developed that communication style we talked about, avoiding definite statements, using phrases like, it seems to me, or perhaps we might consider. It lowered people's defenses, made them feel like they were finding the solution together rather than being told what to do. Very clever.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly and look at three moments that really stand out as pivotal turning points in his life, defining moments. We have to start with him running away to Philadelphia in 1723. Why was that so significant?
Because it was this conscious, deliberate act of self-creation. He wasn't just leaving his brother. He was rejecting the entire life path that seemed set for him by his birth in Puritan Boston.
Breaking the mold.
Completely. It established his own personal founding myth that in America, you could shed your past. You weren't defined by your family, but by your own merit and effort. He literally invented himself in Philadelphia.
Then the second big shift, gaining international scientific fame around 1752 with the electricity experiments. How did that change things?
It put him on a totally different level. Before that, he was, you know, a very successful, wealthy colonial businessman and civic leader. Respected, but mostly within America.
But after?
After. He was an international intellectual figure, a star. That fame gave him a kind of cultural and political clout that no other American politician had at the time. When he later went to Europe, people listened because he was Benjamin Franklin, the man who understood lightning. His science directly empowered his diplomacy.
Okay, and the third turning point. This one sounds painful. The humiliation in the cockpit in 1774. You said this is where the loyal British subject died and the revolutionary was born.
It was incredibly brutal and deeply personal. Franklin had been in London for years, working as an agent for the colonies, trying desperately to bridge the gap with Britain to avoid a split.
He was trying to keep things together.
He really was. But then he got hold of some private letters from the royal governor of Massachusetts, Hutchinson. Letters showed the governor was actually pushing London to crack down hard on the colonists. Franklin leaked them, thinking he would show the colonists that the local officials were the problem, not the British government itself.
Backfired.
Massively. He was summoned before the Privy Council in a room literally called the cockpit. And for over an hour, the Solicitor General, Alexander Wedderburn, just tore into him, publicly accused him of being a thief, a liar, a traitor. Just relentless, vicious humiliation.
And Franklin?
He just stood there, silent. Motionless, apparently wearing a suit of spotted Manchester velvet. He never forgot it. That public shaming, that feeling of personal betrayal by the British establishment he'd tried to work with, it just snapped his emotional ties to Britain.
That was the breaking point.
Absolutely. He left that room a changed man, fully committed to American independence. Years later, when he signed the treaty with France, his great diplomatic triumph, he supposedly wore that very same velvet suit. A deliberate statement.
Wow. Okay, so looking at this incredibly complex life, these huge shifts, what are the big human lessons we can take away? What does his story teach us about ourselves?
Well, one really profound lesson, I think, is about our capacity for moral evolution. Isaacson doesn't shy away from Franklin's difficult relationship with slavery.
Right, he owned enslaved people for decades. His newspaper ran ads for selling people.
He did. For a long time, he accepted it, participated in it. But in his later years, especially towards the very end of his life, he underwent a significant change of heart. He went from acceptance to active condemnation.
Becoming president of an abolition society.
Yes, the Pennsylvania Abolition Society in 1787. He even petitioned the very first U.S. Congress to abolish slavery just months before he died. It shows that, you know, moral growth is possible even late in life, even for someone deeply entangled in the injustices of their time. It's not always easy or quick, but change can happen.
That's powerful. Another thing that strikes me is how he seemed to weave everything together. His life wasn't compartmentalized.
That's a great point. It shows the power of integration. His work, his science, his politics, his civic life. They weren't separate boxes. They all fed into each other.
How so?
Well, his business success gave him the money and freedom to pursue science. His scientific fame gave him the status he needed for effective diplomacy. And his diplomacy helped achieve the political goals, the civic goals he cared about. It's a lesson that individual achievement and community contribution can actually reinforce each other.
And maybe a third lesson, especially relevant today, is about his style of leadership through consensus.
Absolutely. It's such a contrast to so much of our modern polarized discourse. He wasn't about command and control or shouting opponents down.
He built consensus.
Exactly. By listening carefully, by finding common ground, appealing to shared practical interest, using humor to ease tension. He really trusted in the wisdom that could emerge from people working together voluntarily. That's why he loved creating things like the library, the fire company, the university.
Okay, as we wrap up this deep dive, let's try to pull out three final, really potent takeaways from Franklin's life that you, the listener, can reflect on. Let's start with an emotional insight.
I think the most deeply emotional, almost tragic element Isaacson highlights is the irreparable break with his son William. William chose to remain a loyalist during the Revolution. He became the royal governor of New Jersey.
Putting political principle above family.
Above his father, yes. Their final meetings after the war were just cold and filled with unresolved pain. It's a heartbreaking reminder that sometimes, even in the closest relationships, fundamental differences in belief or principle just cannot be bridged. Politics can have devastating personal costs.
A sobering thought. Okay, yeah. An intellectual insight. What's the key intellectual takeaway?
It has to be how he applied the scientific method to everything, not just lightning. His whole life was approached like an ongoing experiment.
How do you mean?
Whether he was improving the postal service, designing a better stove, negotiating a treaty, or setting up the Shunto, he observed the problem. He hypothesized a practical, often collaborative solution. He tested it in the real world, saw what works, what didn't, and then he adjusted. Life itself was a series of problems to be solved empirically.
Fascinating. And finally, a universal insight, something everyone can apply.
It comes back to that project of moral perfection, I think. What he learned wasn't how to be perfect. It was that perfection is impossible, but the striving is what counts. His life shows us that identity isn't fixed. You can always be working on yourself, reinventing yourself, improving at any age. The goal isn't to be flawless. The goal is just to be better today than you were yesterday. That continuous effort, that's the real takeaway.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.